Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am very happy. My guest is Mary Ruffel. She has collected her lectures under the title Madness, Rack, and Honey. And let me tell you, this solves many of my problems. People are always asking me, where can I read a book about poetry, about modern poetry, about death, about fear, about sentiment, about life? And I never know what to tell them. And now I have Madness, Rack, and Honey, which is a book in which a poet, Mary Ruffel, has written everything that she came to know about poetry by having to lecture on the subject of poetry. As she says in the book, she didn't know about poetry, she only wrote poetry, but having to lecture about it gave her the obligation to think about what it is she knows. And to say it in a language, as Randall Jarrell used to say, that even dogs and cats can understand. The thrilling thing about this book is that it's not crammed with theory, the language of theory. It's crammed with the meaning of theory, which is the meaning of being, of existence. Mary, how did this get written? Over what period and with what pain?
With a great deal of pain, I can assure you. And over a period of about 15 years, I would have to deliver these sometimes every 6 months. Sometimes I'd be on leave and it would be 18 months before I'd have to write another one. But every time I had to write one, I was in a state of terror. I was afraid. I know nothing. I don't know how to put into words what I may know. And bit by bit, I learned how to write a lecture. And in many ways, I see the book as my learning how to talk to other people, to a group of people, about things that I loved or things I was interested in or things that terrified me. So it came about slowly over time, and it was learning by doing completely.
Now, I learned within this book many, many useful distinctions. For instance, in particular, the difference between emotion and feeling. Now, would you try and summarize that, and we'll begin to talk about its use in a poem?
For me, the difference between emotion and feeling is that an emotion is a biologically hardwired, I hate the word hardwired, but I'm going to use it for lack of a quicker term. Emotion is a physiological response that all animals, probably all living beings, I bet plants have it too, have in response to when they're being threatened, right? When there's a question that their life, their living beingness may be in doubt. And on the other hand, a feeling is much more complex, and the intellect is brought to bear. By intellect, I mean memories, whether they be conscious or subconscious, things that you know, things that have developed over the course of your lifetime. Those are feelings, and they're distinct from emotions. And feelings, you know, in so many instances, feelings are simply put down. They're just put down in our culture, I feel. And in fact, they're complex and they're intellectual.
Yes, it's emotion plus cognition equals feeling. Yes. And what's exciting is that in one of the essays, you say to us, maybe we should consider not your poetry shouldn't be emotional, put more feelings in the essay. Wow.
Precisely.
And I feel like you've solved at a stroke a question that, when usually resolved, leads to the absence of all feeling from poetry. And it's, oh no, not the bluntness of terrified emotion, mm-hmm. but the complexity and strangeness of fully felt feeling.
Feelings are thoughts. If you think of a feeling as a thought and you begin to translate it in those ways, there's a vast difference. And I think, personally, poetry cannot exist without feeling.
I know someone
could argue with us, but I don't think it can exist.
Can you give an example of a feeling in a poem, even one of your own?
Well, many times I straight out, I will absolutely straight out tell the reader what I'm feeling. So I might say, I woke up feeling like a giraffe who needed to jump a fence, you know. And that's giving, using figurative and imaginative language to articulate my feelings. And that one I just made up. But hopefully, if you use figurative language to describe your feelings, the reader will be able to translate that into a feeling they may have had that was similar.
Now, there's an essay here on sentimentality, which also provides, to my mind, an amazing distinction. Because sentimentality is one of those things that is outlawed, verboten in poetry workshops now. Not in poetry, but in writing workshops. That a poem can be sentimental if it contains all spectrum of sentiment, not just one.
Exactly. That's what so many young writers and students in MFA programs are so... They err in one of two ways. They either go overboard to have no feelings in their poem, all right? Or they think that to put the feelings in, they should only be they're only thinking in one way. I think that the example that I use, and I had no idea what I was going to say when I sat down to write that essay. I have a memory of writing that essay, and the essay forced me to think about it. And in the middle of the essay, I remember being in a place of deep confusion, like I thought I knew what I was going to say, but I had no idea. You know, writing about it is forcing me to think about it. I know I use an anecdote of dolls and faces, and at one point I'm talking about a doll with a sad face will make a sad little girl happy. That's an example that I give. And when you only have one emotion in your poem, only one, it could be happiness, it could be sadness, it could be indifference. If you only have one emotion, that's no face. The doll has no face. You need to think in more than one direction at the same time to be fully human, because ambiguity is at the heart of life.
It seems to me that a lot of poetry has taken a route away from emotion and even the complexity that intellect brings to emotion in order to favor that popular feeling, the dread that people have, that poetry is difficult, hard to understand, and a kind of test. How did this happen? I know how poetry seemed difficult to regular people. How did it become difficult to poets, too?
I think it happened because at some point our intellectual institutions, that would be academia, began to, they were a refuge at one point. Slowly it evolved. They were a place of refuge. Poetry could seek asylum in an institution. But at the same time then, the institution exerted its own environment onto poetry. And for the last 25 years, postmodern theory has been the environment, the weather, if you can call it that. It's the weather of academia, is theory. And it rained on poetry. The cloud was there. We took refuge underneath the cloud, and the cloud burst, and things mutually, these two things mutually influenced each other. And to wonderful result and to sad, sickening result. It's complex. It's life.
This is a terrific book of lectures on poetry and life, and may I say everything else that's been published by Wave Books. They've been putting Mary Ruffel's poems out volume by volume. Beautiful books, and this is a beautiful and well-designed book, a pleasure to hold in the hand. It's thanks to Extremadura, who designs beautiful, beautiful books and is himself a poet. The book is very beautiful because it dares, among other things, to have a title that needs a full lecture to explain it. In fact, tell about it.
Madness, Rack, and Honey was, I dreamt it. I often, not always, but often dream in fragments of language. So I will wake up in the morning and instead of remembering an image or a narrative, all that the dream god has given me is a phrase of language. This happens frequently, and when it does, I put those phrases into poems. But this phrase, madness, rack, and honey, came to me one morning when I had to write a lecture. So I said, madness, rack, and honey, what does that mean? I have to write a lecture. I think I'll write a little essay and try to figure out what it means to me. And so I did.
But now, you had heard an Iranian woman reciting a poem,
yes,
that she said every Iranian person would know above a certain age. And yet you, Mary, you've never been able to find the poem. She swore that it was not by Rumi.
Correct.
But since you knew it was not by Rumi, you've deeded it to
Hafiz. I mean, to this day, I've actually the Wave staff that tried, they worked so hard to connect, I quote, and frequently, and it never occurred to me that these would be published, so I never bothered to write the name of the book. And they, that I was getting the quotes from, and they tried to track it down and couldn't find it. Of course, I only had it in the English translation.
Here is the poem, only three lines. I shall not finish my poem. What I have written is so sweet, the flies are beginning to torment me. Well, it's thrilling because in three lines, this is Plato's problem that when art becomes so real that it attracts the bugs, he says that the poet has become a madman, is rivaling the gods. The flies are drawn to the honey. The rack is the torture. And the madness is the madness of poetry, of going between the art life and the world, and that both the reader and the poet are doing a kind of dance of madness, rack and honey.
It's true. And I use that little three-line poem to talk about the title, and you've just beautifully explained how I find Madness, Rack, and Honey in those lines. You know, the imagination is a complex and ambiguous thing in itself. The imagination has the power to enrich a world, deeply enrich a world, and to make it fuller and brighter and bigger. But at the same time, the imagination also has the power to distort in monstrous ways. And that is the crux of being a poet or an artist of any kind. That the imagination, which I believe is behind all worthwhile artistic endeavors, is a two-faced monster. It's a monster god.
Yeah. Wow. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mary Ruffel about her book of lectures, Madness, Rack, and Honey. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mary Ruffel about her new book, Madness, Rack, and Honey. It's wonderful because they're not essays, they're lectures. So they have in them the sound of someone talking to you. Not only that, someone who has at heart you're not getting lost, by teaching you that getting lost is beautiful and fun and simple and revealing. And, you know, so the combination of lostness and explanation, finding, losing and finding and losing and finding, which you say is essentially the action of the poem itself, breathing.
Yes, yes. Losing and finding and is every poem moves forward by getting lost and then finding itself and then getting lost and finding itself.
And the most beautiful thing, I think, is that instead of the usual, even in books by poets, the quotes are from writers and artists and architects. It's not literary critics, by and large. And so when we go, we find quotes from Georges Bataille and Samuel Beckett and John Berger and Emily Dickinson. I mean, it's so vast. You will find, dare I say it, a quote for every occasion, as you say, that people like poems for occasions. Well, you'll find a lecture topic for marriage and death and birth and sadness. I mean, this book really, I think everyone I know would love it. And I sat reading it feeling alternately elated and heartbroken. Can you tell me about heartbreak, Mary?
Indeed, I can tell you about heartbreak, except that there are no words for it. Heartbreak, I think our hearts are broken every day if we're attentive. How can they not be? The world was built to astonish and overwhelm. And astonishment and being astonished and overwhelmed, that happens in our moments of greatest joy, happiness, ecstasy. But astonishment, being astonished and overwhelmed, is also an apt description of our darkest moments of deepest suffering. It's the astonishment and the overwhelmment, if that's a word, that fits all occasions. Again, we're going back again to the doll with the sad face making a girl happy. To let yourself be astonished and overwhelmed at every moment whether it's coming from above or below. That's the important thing, to understand these experiences are not polar opposites. They are linked in essential ways.
Well, I'm reminded, you quote the great French poet and essayist Paul Valéry, but I'm reminded of something that you don't quote but that I love. He says, God made the universe out of nothing, but he let the nothing show through.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I love him. He's a god of mine, Paul Valéry. That's a beautiful, beautiful quote by him.
And from, you know, from all to nothing is what a poem ideally in some way comprises. For so many years when I didn't understand poetry, and there were a lot of years, I didn't understand that a poem takes you from everything to nothing. And it's in what you call that transfer of energy.
I never have anything to say when I begin a poem. When I begin a poem, I have nothing to say. And I think the poem is my way of saying, I have nothing to say, give me a moment and I'll talk forever. That's my experience of writing.
Yeah, I was so moved. There's a tiny poem here. Mary doesn't quote a lot of her own work in this book, which is one of the few risks that she doesn't take. In other words, this is a book that's full of personal risk. But one here is a fragment of four lines. Bin of animals at the Goodwill, all my friends in one place.
That's my haiku. It's from my series of bleak haiku. I had forgotten those are the only lines of my own work I quote in the book.
Translation of the Native American poem.
Oh, correct.
Yeah.
Bin of animals at the Goodwill, all of my friends in one place. Yeah. I mean that quite literally.
Yeah.
I suppose the literal and the figurative come together there, but stuffed animals that have been abandoned because the child has grown up, but the stuffed animal hasn't, and then they're taken to the Goodwill, and they're all thrown in a bin together, and every time I confront it, I search through them looking for I'm always looking for a certain expression. I'm looking for the one that will speak to me. And then when I do, I just have to adopt it or find a home for it.
Tell me, are poets different from other people?
I don't think they're different from other people, but they do, in general, they have a facility with language. As their medium that would distinguish them. Actually, to be honest, Michael, I could write a lecture about that question because it's haunting me. For years and years and years, I would always say to my students, look, you are not here because you have more emotions than anyone else. Think about that, how insulting that is to a human being. You are here in this room because you have a facility with language. That's the only thing that makes you different from anyone else. All human beings have the same feeling. But now as I age, I'm not so sure that's true. Maybe, just maybe, I've been wrong, and maybe I haven't been able to face the fact that maybe we are more touchy-feeling than other people. I just don't know. It's something I have to think about.
I think it has something to do with the look that poets or people whose art is poetic see the presence of soul in things before other people see them. Every time I've known, I knew a man so sensitive that in a antique shop, even a junk shop, he would find a barrel, he would dip his hand in and, without even looking, pull out the handkerchief that had embroidered along its edges a cockfight with the roosters tearing at each other and the bits of blood embroidered between the roosters. And I'd say, how did you do that? It was like dowsing. And I think that's a poet's gift, that you find, often without wanting to, the animate expression of something too deep for words.
That's exactly what I'm looking for when I rummage through the bin of stuffed animals and I find the little bear with the saddest expression in the world on his face. The saddest. Who could have conceived of making this to cheer a child up? And yet I get it. That's the animal that cheers me up.
And I think these are the lectures that cheer one up because they go to the bottom. They see into the abyss and they stay on the surface at the same time. It's a lovely gift.
Is it a gift? Or I want to give other people a gift.
I think it's a gift. Do you think it's a punishment?
No. Never a punishment. Never a punishment. Never in a million years.
I've been talking with Mary Ruffel, author most recently of Madness, Rack, and Honey, published by Wave Books, who also publish her selected poems. Thank you, Mary, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Madness, Rack, and Honey at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Tell us what you're thinking about the conversation on our website, our archive. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craigor Thine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Neal Stephenson is our guest.